Track 11.
Do you believe in God, Al-Amhara? The mullah insisted. Yes, of course, Dorian said quickly. I believe in God eternal, in his Son eternal, and the Holy Ghost eternal. The litany of the order that he had listened to Tom reciting by heart came readily to his tongue. Al-Alama tried not to let his alarm and repugnance show in the face of such blasphemy. There is but one God, he said solemnly, and Muhammad is his last true prophet. Dorian had no interest in this assertion, but he enjoyed arguing, especially with anyone in authority. How do you know that? He challenged. How do you know I am wrong and you are right? Al-Alama rose to the challenge, and Dorian leaned back, let the torrent of religious rhetoric wash over him, while he dreamed of other things. Dorian wished there was a place for him at the masthead, as there had been on the Seraph, a place high above the sea where he could be alone. However, the Latin-rigged dhow did not afford this possibility, and he had to watch from the deck with the rest of the crew as the African mainland came up over the horizon, a dark, mysterious landmass. He wrinkled his nose as he smelt its animal odour on the air. It was the smell of dust and spice and mangrove swamp. The alien aroma was a mild shock to the senses, but it was alluring and enticing after the salt-seared airs of the ocean, which had cleared his nose and heightened his sense of smell. Standing beside Faoud at the helm as they closed the land, Dorian had his first view of the island of Lamu. Faoud pointed out its main features and gave him a brief history of this jewel in the territories of the Caliphate of the Omani. My people have traded here since the time of the Prophet, and before, when we were also infidels and strangers to the great truth, he explained proudly. This was an important port when Zanzibar was still a crocodile-infested swamp. Laboriously, the dhow tacked up the channel between the island and the mainland, and Faoud pointed out the dark green hills above the white beaches. The prince has a palace on the mainland where he lives in the dry season, but in the wet he moves to the island. He pointed out the white buildings that from this distance looked like surf breaking on a coral reef. Lamu is richer than Zanzibar. Her buildings are more beautiful and magnificent. The Sultan of Zanzibar is a vassal of our prince and pays tribute to him. There was a gathering of craft in the anchorage, and dozens of other vessels were coming in or setting out to sea. Some were fishing boats, and others were large, heavily laden traders, or lighter, faster slavers, proof of the prosperity and importance of this thriving port. Those ships they passed recognized the Prince's dhow by the green pennants she flew at her masthead, and by the impressive figure of Abd Muhammad al-Malik, sitting under the awning on the foredeck, surrounded by his court. They dipped their colours in respect and shouted their loyal greetings and blessings across the water. May the love of Allah and the smile of his prophet follow you all your days. The dhows at anchor in the bay fired their guns and beat their war drums. The boom of cannon shot carried to the shore, and as the prince and his retinue sailed into the harbour, they saw a vast crowd gathering on the beach and wharf to greet him. In their tiny cabin, Tahi dressed Dorian in a fresh white robe and covered his shining hair with a headcloth. She placed leather sandals on his feet, then took his hand and led him up on deck. Faoud took the dhow into the beach. The tide was running out swiftly, for here the tidal range at full springs was 20 feet. The ship took the ground and heeled as the tide ran out from under her. A gang of slaves waded out to the stranded vessel to carry the prince and other notables to the beach. A huge black man, clad only in a loincloth, took the prince on his back, and the waiting crowds fell to their knees and shouted their greetings. A band of musicians played a high-pitched wailing tune, which offended Dorian's ear. The pipes and fifes sobbed, and the drums banged and boomed without rhythm. Tahi would have carried Dorian to the beach, but he avoided her embrace and splashed joyfully through the surf, wetting himself to the armpits. There was a brief ceremony of welcome for the prince on the beach, then Al-Malik mounted a black stallion. From horseback he looked about quickly and caught Tahi's eye. She stood in the crowd, holding Dorian's hand. She rushed forward with Dorian, and the prince spoke to her imperiously. Take Al-Amhara to the Zenana. Kush will provide quarters for both of you. Dorian was too interested in the prince's horse to take much notice of the words that decided his fate. He loved horses almost as much as he did boats and the sea. Tom had taught him to ride as soon as he could walk. Al-Malik's mount was a magnificent animal, much different from those he had known at High Weald. It was smaller and more graceful, with large limpid eyes and flared nostrils, a long back and strong, delicate legs. He reached up and stroked its muzzle. The stallion snuffled his fingers and then tossed its head.
"He's beautiful," Dorian laughed.
The prince looked down on him with a faint smile that softened his fierce, hawk-handsome features. A boy who was a seaman born, and who also loved horses, had all his approval. "Take good care of him. See to it that he does not try to run away," he ordered Tahi and the eunuch Kush, who had come forward to answer the prince's charge. Al-Malik lifted the stallion's head with a touch on the reins and rode away down the street of the port, which was carpeted with palm fronds in his honour. The musicians and the crowds closed in behind him, and singing and clapping followed his procession up towards the towering walls of the fort. Kush gathered up the women from the prince's household as they came ashore from the dhow. There were two of the youngest concubines, heavily veiled, but slim and graceful under the layers of black robes. Their hands and feet were beautifully formed, dyed with henna, and decorated with precious rings of sapphire and emerald on fingers and toes. They giggled a great deal, which annoyed Dorian, and their maidservants were even worse, noisy as a flock of starlings. He was pleased when they were shepherded by Kush into the first bullock cart. Tahi led Dorian into the second. The bullocks were pure white, with a huge spread of horns and massive humps on their shoulders, like the drawings of camels Dorian had seen in the books of travel in the library at High Weald. He wanted to run beside the cart, but Kush restrained him with a podgy hand on his shoulder. There were gold rings on each of the eunuch's fingers, and the jewels set in them caught the bright tropical sunlight and sparked the eye. "Ride beside me, little one," he said in a high feminine voice, and when Dorian would have demurred, Tahi pinched his arm so hard it hurt. He interpreted this as a warning that Kush was a man, or rather a thing of power, and must be placated. The procession of carts left the seashore, passed through the outskirts of the port and into the countryside. They trundled down the narrow, dusty road into the interior of the verdant island. They rolled through groves of swaying coconut palms and forests of wild fig trees. Flocks of brightly coloured parrots and wild green pigeons swarmed in the branches, greedily devouring the ripening fruits. Dorian had never seen birds like these before. He followed their jewelled flight with exclamations of wonder. Kush studied him carefully through bright black eyes, almost buried in rolls of fat.
"Who taught you, a Frank, to speak the language of the prophet?" he asked suddenly.
And with a sigh, Dorian gave him the response that had become worn and weary with repetition.
"Are you of Islam, or is it true that you are an infidel?"
"I am a Christian," Dorian said proudly. Kush screwed up his fat face as though he had tasted a green persimmon.
"Then how is it that your hair is the same colour as that of the prophet?" he demanded. "Or is this a lie? What colour is your hair? Why do you hide it?"
Dorian adjusted the drape of his headcloth. He was irked by the constant harping on this one subject. There was so much else of interest all around him. He wished the fat one would leave him alone to enjoy it all.
"Show me your hair,"
Kush insisted, and reached for the headcloth. Dorian started to pull away, but Tahi spoke sharply, and he allowed Kush to lift the cloth from his head. Kush gazed in amazement as Dorian's thick, curling locks tumbled down to his shoulders and flared in the sunlight like a fire in tall grass. The other passengers riding in the back of the cart exclaimed and called on Allah to witness the wonder of it, and even the bullock drivers turned back and walked beside the high wheel to stare up at him. Hastily, Dorian covered his head. After a mile, the track wound out of the forest, and ahead rose the high, blank wall of the Zenana. It was built of coral blocks and painted with burnt lime wash to a dazzling white. There were no windows, and the only opening was a gate, carved from teak and decorated with complicated designs of vines and foliage, obeying the Islamic stricture that forbids depictions of human forms or those of other living creatures. The gates swung open as the little caravan of carts approached, and they proceeded through into the closed, forbidden world of the Zanana. This was the home of the women and their offspring, and of the eunuchs who guarded them. Other than the prince, no grown man might enter here at the peril of his very life. The women and children gathered just inside the gates to greet the procession of bullock carts. Many had not left these cloistered precincts since childhood. Any distraction delighted them. They chattered and shrieked with excitement, and came close around the carts to inspect the occupants and to find any strange face among them. "There he is. It is true. He is a Frank. Is his hair really red? Surely it cannot be." Here, in the seclusion of the harem, the females could go unveiled. The prince had the choice of any girl in his realm, and most were young and comely. Their skin colours ranged from purple-black through all shades of brown, gold, and amber to soft, buttery yellow. Their children danced around them, caught up in the excitement. The babes in the nurses' arms wailed in the uproar. The women crowded forward to have a closer look at Dorian as he jumped down from the cart, then followed as Kush led them through a maze of courtyards and enclosed gardens. These were richly decorated with mosaic floors and elaborate archways. Seashells had been inlaid in the plaster to form intricate designs. There were pools filled with reeds and lotus plants. Gem-like fish glided beneath the water, and dragonflies and bright kingfishers hovered over the surface. Some of the elder children danced around Dorian, chanting and teasing him, "Little white infidel, green devil eyes!" Kush pretended to swipe at them with the long staff he carried, but he was grinning and made no real attempt to drive them away. Swiftly they passed from the splendid and beautiful area of the Zanana into the more dilapidated part, in the back regions of the main complex of the buildings. It was clear that this was the least desirable section. The gardens were unkempt and the walls stained and unpainted. They passed several abandoned ruins, overgrown with tropical growth, and reached a dilapidated block. Kush took them to a small but sturdy door and ordered them to enter. They found themselves in a large living room, dark and not too clean. The walls were soot-stained, the floors dusty and covered with the droppings of gecko lizards and rats. Kush closed the doors firmly behind them and turned a massive key in the lock. Tahi shouted at him through the tiny grill in the door, "Why are you locking us away? We are not prisoners. We are not criminals. The mighty Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik has ordered that the child be prevented from escaping. He cannot escape. There is no place for him to run to." Kush ignored her protests and strode away, taking most of the others with him. For a while, some of the royal children mocked them through the grill, but they soon tired of this and drifted away. When all was quiet, Dorian and Tahi began to explore their quarters. Apart from the living room, there were sleeping chambers and a little kitchen with an open hearth. Next to it was the washroom with a tiled floor sloped to an open drain. Beyond was the latrine, with covered buckets. The furnishings were sparse. Sleeping mats of plaited reeds and sitting rugs of woven wool. There were cooking pots and water jars in the kitchen, and naturally they would eat with their fingers in the Arabic fashion. There was a large ceramic rainwater cistern which supplied fresh water. Dorian looked up at the opening in the kitchen roof that allowed smoke to escape. "I could easily climb out of there," he boasted. "If you do, Kush will thrash you with his staff," Tahi told him, "so do not even think of it. Come and help me clean out the sty." As they worked together, sweeping out the bare rooms with brooms of reeds, then polishing the clay floors with half-coconut shells, Tahi explained to him the rules of the Zanana. As a royal nursemaid since her husband had divorced her, Tahi had lived in the confines of the Zanana, and she was an expert on the affairs of its restricted society. Over the days that followed, she shared this knowledge with Dorian. Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik was in his early 30s. His elder brother, the Caliph, for reasons of his own succession, had prevented him from marrying until he was almost 20. Thus it was that his eldest son was only little older than Dorian. His name was Zayn al-Din, and like Dorian, he had not yet reached puberty. He still lived with his mother in the Zanana. "Remember his name," Tahi instructed. "As the eldest son, he is very important." Then she went on to list the names of the other male children, by the other wives and concubines, but there were so many that Dorian made no effort to memorize them. Tahi did not even bother to mention the girls, because they were of no importance. In the weeks that followed, it seemed that the prince had forgotten about his red-headed slave boy. They heard nothing more from the outside walls of the Zenana. Every day, under Kush's beady eye, slave women came to bring them their rations of rice, meat, and fresh fish, and to carry away the rubbish from the kitchen and the buckets from the latrine. Apart from that, Dorian and Tahi were left to themselves. There were grill windows in the main room of their quarters, which overlooked a section of the gardens. To relieve the boredom of their confinement, they spent much of their time watching the comings and goings of the other members of the Zenana from this vantage point. Tahi was able to point out Zayn al-Din to Dorian. He was a large, plump child, taller than any of his siblings. He had a sallow, caramel complexion. His mouth was pouting and petulant. The skin around his eyes was discoloured, as though it was bruised. "Zayn has a taste for sweet things," Tahi explained. There were livid patches of prickly heat on the inside of his elbows and knees. He walked splay-legged to prevent his thighs rubbing together and the skin between them chafing. Whenever Dorian saw him, Zayn was surrounded by a dozen or so of his siblings. One morning he watched as this pack pursued a smaller boy across the lawns and trapped him against the outer wall of the Zenana. They dragged him to Zayn, who had not exerted himself in the chase, but came waddling up when it was over. Tahi was watching also, and she told Dorian that the victim was the son of a lesser concubine of the prince, and therefore fair game for the eldest son of the first wife. Dorian, who knew all about the rights of the firstborn from his dealings with brother William, felt his sympathy go out to the little boy as he watched Zayn twisting his ears until he sank to his knees, weeping with fear. "As punishment for what you have done, I make you my horse," Zayn told him loudly, and forced him down onto all fours. Then he bestrode him and lowered his full weight onto the other child's back. He had a cane in his hand, made from a palm frond, from which the leaves had been stripped. "Gallop, horse," he ordered, and lashed him across the bottom. The palm frond was lithe and whippy. It snapped loudly, and the little boy wailed with shock and pain. He started forward on hands and knees, with Zayn bouncing on his back. The other children fell in behind them, prancing, jeering, and urging them on. When the boy faltered, they joined in the beating, some running to break sticks from the nearest shrubs. One flipped up the child's robe and exposed his brown bottom, laced with angry stripes. They drove him twice around the lawns. Tears were flooding down the victim's face when at last he collapsed under Zayn's weight and lay sobbing on the coarse grass. His knees were rubbed raw and bleeding. Zayn gave him a casual kick, then led the others away, leaving him to drag himself up and limp away. "He is a bully," Dorian said furiously. He could not think of the word in Arabic, so he spoke in English. Tahi shrugged. "The Quran says that the strong should protect the weak," Dorian lapsed back into Arabic. Tahi advised him, "Do not tell Zayn al-Din that. He will not like it." "I would like to take him for a ride," Dorian said furiously, "and see how much he likes it." Tahi made the sign to avert bad luck. "Do not even think the thought. Walk wide of Zayn al-Din," she warned. "He is a vindictive boy. Surely he will hate you for the favour the prince has shown you. He can do us much harm. Even Kush is afraid of him, for one day he will be the prince." Over the following days, she went on explaining to Dorian the hierarchy of the harem. The prince was allowed 4 wives by the decree of the prophet. However, he could divorce and remarry as he wished, and there was no limit to the number of concubines with whom he might indulge himself. Those wives he had divorced, but who had borne him children, still lived in the Zenana. Thus, almost 50 women were congregated within these walls. 50 beautiful, bored, frustrated women with nothing to fill the long days but intrigue, feud, and jealous scheming. It was a complex society, filled with innumerable currents and subtle nuances. Kush reigned over them all. So his favour or disfavour was important to the happiness and well-being of the inmates. Then the four current wives, in order of seniority, were next in importance. After that, the prince's favourite of the moment. But she was usually some pretty child only just entered into womanhood, and her star would soon wane. Then all the former wives and the concubines squabbled, fought, and manoeuvred for position in the order of things. It is important for you to understand these things, Al-Amhara. Important for both of us. I have no standing at all. I am only a poor old nursemaid. I can do little to protect you, and nobody will miss me. Are you going somewhere? Dorian demanded with alarm. He had grown so fond of her in the short time they had been together, and the prospect of being abandoned yet again frightened him. I will miss you. I am not going anywhere, my little one, she assured him quickly. But people die here in the Zenana, especially little people of no consequence who give offence to those above them. Don't worry, I will protect you, Dorian told her stoutly, and hugged her. I feel safer in your care. She did not let him see her smile. But we do not yet know your position. It seems that the prince looks upon you with some favour, but we cannot yet be sure. Why does he allow Kush to imprison us and treat us like animals in a cage? Why does he not send for you? Has he forgotten you? She sighed and returned his embrace. Perhaps he does not know how Kush treats us, Dorian suggested. Perhaps, she agreed. So we must wait. In the meantime, we must be careful, Al-Amhara. Very careful. Time passed, and the excitement of their arrival was forgotten. No one peered at them through the grill anymore, and the children led by Zayn al-Din became bored with chanting insults under the windows and found other occupations more rewarding. Each day Dorian chafed more cruelly at his confinement. When he heard the shrill cries and happy laughter of other children at play in the gardens, and heard their running footsteps along the cloisters and across the courtyard outside his meagre quarters, he would rush to the window for a glimpse of them. This only aggravated his loneliness and sense of isolation. He felt as imprisoned as he had been in his cell on the island where Al-Awuf had chained him. One morning, as the pearly light of a new day filtered through the high window in his room, he lay naked on his sleeping mat, stripping the hard outer lining off a stick of sugar cane with his teeth. He paused as someone began singing in the garden outside. It was a sweet, girlish voice, even though the words were repetitive and nonsensical, some nursery rhyme about palm dates and a hungry monkey. He lay and listened to it idly, chewing the sweet juice out of the cane and spitting out the pith. Suddenly there came the shrill but unmistakable chatter of a monkey. The singer broke off the refrain and burst into peals of silvery laughter. Both sounds intrigued Dorian, who jumped up and went to the window. He peered out into the garden and saw a small girl sitting alone on the coping of the lotus pool below him. She had her back to him, but her hair hung down it, dark, almost iridescent black, with a silver streak gleaming through the thick tresses. Dorian had never seen anything like it, and he was fascinated. She wore an embroidered green shift, which left her brown arms bare, and a pair of baggy white cotton trousers. Her legs were doubled up under her, and he could see that the soles of her small feet were dyed with henna to a bright ginger colour. She was holding up a sugared date, and a vervet monkey stood on its back legs and danced on the grass in front of her. Each time she gave a hand signal, the monkey chattered louder and spun in a circle. The girl laughed with delight. Finally, she offered the sweetmeat and called, "Come to me, Ginny." The monkey bounded up onto her shoulder and took the date from her fingers. It stuffed it into its pouch and began searching in the girl's hair with skinny black fingers as though for fleas. The girl stroked its fluffy white belly and began singing again. Suddenly, the ape looked up and saw Dorian's head in the window. It let out a squeak, shot off the girl's shoulder and up the wall. Hanging on the sill, it thrust its hand through the window grill, palm up like a beggar, trying to wheedle the stick of sugarcane from him. Dorian laughed at the creature, which bared its teeth, bobbed its head at him, and tried to snatch the sugarcane from his hand, at the same time gibbering and pulling faces. The girl swung around and looked up. "Make him do a trick," she called. "Don't feed him until he does." Dorian saw that she also had a funny little monkey face and huge eyes the colour of Devon honey when the heather on the moors was in bloom. "Do this with your hand," she demonstrated, and at the signal the monkey threw itself into an agile back somersault. "Make him do it 3 times," the girl clapped her hands. "Ginny must do it 3 times." On the 3rd somersault, Dorian offered him the sugar cane. The monkey snatched it, galloped across the lawn on all fours, tail held high, and shot to the top branches of one of the tamarind trees. He sat there chewing it with the sweet juices dripping from his lips. "I know who you are," the girl announced solemnly, looking up at Dorian with those huge eyes. "Who am I?"
"You are Al-Amkhara, the infidel."
Until now he had been indifferent to what they called him. But suddenly it displeased him. "My real name is Dorian, but you can call me Dorry. That's what my brother calls me."
"Dowie,"
she tried it out, but had difficulty rolling the R.
"It's a strange name, but I shall call you Dowie."
"What is your name?" he wanted to know.
"Yasmini," she told him, "which means the flower of the jasmine."
She jumped up and came closer, staring up at him with an awed and serious expression.
"Your hair really is red. I thought they were making it up."
She held her head on one side.
"It is very pretty. I wish I could touch it."
"Well, you cannot," he told her shortly. But she showed no offence at his tone.
"I feel very sorry for you," she said.
"Why should you?" He was taken aback.
"Because Zain says you are an infidel. You will never be circumcised, and you can never enter the gardens of paradise."
"We have our own heaven," Dorian told her loftily. He found discussion of his nether regions vaguely disconcerting.
"Where is it?"
Yasmini wanted to know, and they fell into a long, involved discussion of the various merits of the two paradises.
"Our paradise is called Jannat," she said. "Allah said, I have prepared for my righteous servants what no eye has seen and no ear has heard, and what the mind of man has not conceived."
Dorian considered that in silence and could think of no suitable retort. Jannat was difficult to beat. So he changed the subject to something of which he felt more certain.
"In England, my father has 50 horses. How many does your father have?"
After that, Yasmini came every morning, bringing Ginny with her. She sat under Dorian's window with the monkey on her shoulder and listened, her eyes glowing, as he tried to explain to her what ice was and how snow fell from the sky, why Englishmen had only one wife, and how some had hair the colour of the golden bangles on her ankles, as well as flaming red like his, how the girls curled their golden hair with hot irons, and the men shaved theirs off and wore wigs, the colour and style of the women's dresses, and the fact that they did not wear trousers like she did, but went naked under their skirts.
"That is very uncouth," she said primly. "And is it true, as Zain says, that you even eat the flesh of pigs?"
"The skin goes all crackly when it's roasted," he said, to shock her. "It crunches in your teeth." She made her eyes wider still and pretended to vomit.
"That is truly disgusting. No wonder you cannot go to paradise with us."
"We do not wash 5 times a day like your people do. Sometimes we don't wash at all during the entire winter. It's much too cold," he told her with relish.
"You must smell then as bad as the pigs you eat."
She knew nothing of the world outside, but she was an expert on the affairs of the Zenana. She told him that her mother was one of the divorced wives of the prince, but that she had 2 brothers, so they were still in favour.
"If it were only me, it would be different, because I am only a girl, and my father does not like daughters."
She said it in a matter-of-fact tone, devoid of self-pity. "But my mother is of royal blood. She is the niece of the great mogul. So the emperor is my great-uncle," she told him proudly.
"So you are a princess?" Yes, but only a little one, and not very grand.
Her candour was disarming.
Do you see the silver streak in my hair?
She pirouetted to display it.
My mother has the same streak, and my grandfather also.
It is a mark of royalty. When she explained the relationship of the other children, Dorian listened with more attention than he had to Tai.
Zayn al-Din is my half-brother, but I do not like him. He is fat and cruel,
she considered Dorian thoughtfully.
Is it true that my father has adopted you?
Yes, it is true.
Then you are also my brother.
I think I like you better than Zayn, even though you eat pig meat.
Do you like me, al-Amhara? Zayn says I look like genie.
She stroked the monkey on her shoulder.
Do you think I look like a monkey?
I think you are very pretty, Dorian told her gallantly. And when she smiled, it was true.
My mother says that my father, the prince, has gone away to see my uncle, who is the caliph in Muscat.
When will he return? Dorian asked quickly. This must be the reason that he and Tahi had been neglected. The prince was not here to protect them.
Will he come back soon? My mother says he may be gone a long time, perhaps a year or more.
Yasmini put her head on one side to study his face.
If you are verily my brother, perhaps our father will take you riding and hawking with him when he comes back. I wish I were a boy so I could go with you, she said,
and jumped up from where she sat on the edge of the lotus pond.
I must go now. Kush must not catch me here. He has forbidden any of us to talk to you. He will beat me if he finds me.
Come again tomorrow, he said, trying not to make it sound like a plea.
Perhaps,
she flung over her shoulder as she raced away across the lawn with Jeannie prancing around her flying bare feet. When she was gone, Dorian looked up at the sky, watched the gulls wheeling overhead, listened to the distant sound of the surf beating on the shore, and thought desperately about trying to escape. He imagined climbing out through the open roof of the kitchen, of clambering over the outer wall of the Zenana and finding a small boat on the beach. But where would I go in it, he wondered, and the fantasy shriveled and died. I will have to wait for Tom to come. He resigned himself once more to the inevitable. One morning, Kush came rattling his keys and shouted in his shrill, squeaky voice,
Tahi, you are to prepare the boy to visit the Holy Mola.
He threw down an armful of clean clothing.
I will come back to fetch him after the midday prayers. Make certain that he is ready, or I will have you beaten until you bleed.
The bullock cart was waiting at the gates, and Dorian clambered on board, almost beside himself with excitement and the joy of being allowed out of his bleak prison. Tahi was not coming with him, but she'd been allowed to sun herself in the gardens during his absence. Kush rode beside Dorian on the front seat of the cart, smiling and caressing him.
These robes suit you well. They are of the finest quality. See the embroidery on the collar? It is of silk. Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik has a robe just like this. I chose it specially for you. See how I spoil you.
The closer they came to the palace, the more agitated and conciliatory Kush became.
Have some of these sugared cinnamon cakes. They are my favourites. You will like them also. I want you to be happy, al-Amhara.
When they came in sight of the white walls of the fort, Kush became more direct in his instruction.
If Al-Alama, blessed be his sainted name, should ask how I have treated you, you must tell him that I have been like a father to you, that you have been given the first choice of the finest foods, the freshest fish, and the choicest fruits for your kitchen.
And that you have locked me in a stinking hot room like a criminal, Dorian asked innocently.
That is not true. Perhaps I have been a little too concerned for your safety, that is all.
Though he was smiling, his eyes were as cold as those of a cobra.
Do not try to make trouble for me, little infidel. I can be a better friend than an enemy. Ask that fat old sow, Tahi. She will tell you.
They climbed down from the cart in the outer courtyard of the fort. Kush took his hand and led him into the labyrinth of the building. They climbed several staircases, and at last came out onto a terrace high above the harbour, which looked out across the waters of the channel to the mass of the African mainland. Dorian looked about eagerly. It was a delight to see the sea again, and to have the salt-laden breeze of the monsoon in his face. cleaning his head of the stale smells of the zenana. He saw the mullah at once and made a bow of respect, touching his heart and his lips. Al-Alama greeted him and said, "May Allah keep you smiling, little one." There was another man sitting beside the mullah, cross-legged under the sun awning of split bamboo. He was sipping a small cup of thick black coffee, and a tall glass hookah stood close at hand. "Salam alaikum, old father," Dorian said respectfully, and the man turned to look at him. Dorian's heart leapt, and his face lit with joy as he recognized him. He rushed forward to embrace him. "Ben Abram," he clung to the old doctor, "I thought I would never see you again. I thought you would still be with Al-Auf on the island." Gently the old man fended off his embrace and rearranged his ruffled beard. It was not seemly to allow the others to see the strength of the relationship he and the boy shared. "Let me look at you." He held Dorian away at arm's length and studied his face. His expression changed. "You look pale. What has happened to you, my child?" He swiveled round and looked up at Kush, who was hovering anxiously at the rear of the terrace. "You have been in charge of the boy. What have you done to him, eunuch?" Outside the zenana, Kush was only a house slave, a castrated slave at that. Ben Abram made no effort to disguise his contempt. "I call on Allah and his saints to witness," Kush's jowls quivered, and a light sweat broke out on his chin. "I have cherished him. He has been well fed and cosseted, as though he was the true son of my master." Ben Abram looked at Dorian for confirmation, knowing he would receive a direct answer. "He has locked me in a dingy little room since the day I arrived. He has fed us on pig swill, and I have not been allowed to speak to anyone but my nurse in all that time." Ben Abram stared at Kush coldly, and the eunuch fell to his knees. "It was on the orders of the prince, your honour. He commanded me to keep the child from escaping." "The prince paid a lakh of rupees in gold for this child. He has formally declared him his adopted son," Ben Abram replied, in a soft voice filled with menace. "When His Royal Highness returns from Muscat, I shall inform him in person how you have cared for his son."
"I only did my duty, merciful lord," Kush blubbered.
"I know full well how you discharge that duty towards some of the children and women in your care, eunuch." Ben Abram paused significantly.
"Sometimes it is my duty to punish those who disobey the prince's commands."
"I recall the girl Fatima," Ben Abram mused.
"She was a whore and a harlot," Kush justified himself.
"She was 16 years of age and in love," Ben Abram contradicted him.
"She had a lascivious animal come into her over the wall of the zenana."
"He was a young warrior, an officer of the royal guard," Ben Abram corrected him.
"It was my duty, lord. I did not intend her to die. It was meant only to be a lesson to the others."
Ben Abram raised his hand to quieten any further protestations of innocence. "Hear me, eunuch, and believe what I tell you. If any further harm befalls this boy, nay, if in the future you treat him with less than the greatest consideration, I will see to it that you scream even louder than did little Fatima." Al-Alama had been listening intently to all this. Now he spoke. "All that Ben Abram has ordered, I endorse. The child and his nurse must be given decent quarters and well fed. You must not confine him, nor place unnecessary restriction on him. He must be able to come and go like any other of the prince's sons. He will come to me for instruction every other day, and I shall question him strictly on how he has been treated. Now get out of my sight," he waved Kush away. "Wait below to take the boy back when he is ready." As Kush crept away, he shot a glance rank with venom at Dorian. Ben Abram turned back to Dorian. "There is much I have to tell you. Did you hear of the fighting on the island after you had left?"
No, I have heard none of this. Tell me, old father, tell me everything."
"Not all of it is good news," Ben Abram warned him, and he began to talk quietly. Dorian listened intently. He exclaimed with pride and excitement when he heard of the attack on the fortress of Flor de la Mar, and how Tom had killed Al-Auf with his own hands.
Al-Auf was a beast. I am so proud of Tom. I wish I had been there to watch it.
But he wept when he heard of his father's wounding and how he had lost both of his legs.
Is he dead, old father? Please tell me he is still alive.
In all truth, little one, I do not know. He was alive when your brother allowed me to leave the island. I think your brother planned to take him back to England.
To England?
Dorian was distraught.
That is so far away. He may never come back. Has Tom deserted me?
The tears welled up and broke over his eyelids. He let them run unheeded down his cheeks. Then Abram took his hands and found that the boy was trembling as though in the throes of a high fever.
Your brother is a good man, a man of honour. He showed me great kindness.
But if he has gone back to England,
Dorian broke off and swallowed painfully,
he will forget about me. I will never see him again.
Then that will be the will of God. In the meantime, you are the son of the prince, and you must be attentive to his wishes.
Ben Abram rose to his feet.
Now you must obey the holy Al-Alama, for he has returned from Muscat ahead of the prince, and it is his royal highness's command that you should submit yourself to the mullah's instruction.
Sipping numerous cups of coffee and sucking on the water pipe, Ben Abram waited while the religious instruction went on through the hottest hours of the day. Once or twice he made a comment or asked a question, but mostly he listened in silence. Dorian was comforted by his quiet presence. The sun was casting the long shadows of the palms over the beach below them when Ben Abram asked for the mullah's blessing and took Dorian to where Kush waited in the bullock cart to take him back to the Zenana. Ben Abram stopped out of earshot of the eunuch and spoke quietly.
I will see you as often as I am able to, he promised, whenever you come for lessons with the mullah.
He lowered his voice to a whisper.
Your brother showed me great kindness. If it were not for him, I too would have been sold into slavery. Because of this, I promised him to bring you a message. I could not repeat it with the mullah listening. It is for you only to hear.
What was the message? Please tell me, old father.
Your brother asked me to tell you that he would always hold true to the oath he swore to you. Do you remember that oath?
He said he would come back for me,
Dorian whispered.
He swore a dreadful oath.
Yes, little one. To me he affirmed his promise. He will return for you. I should not tell you this. It is against the interests of my master, but I could not deprive you of the comfort of your brother's words.
I knew he would never forget that oath.
Dorian touched the old man's sleeve.
Thank you for telling me this.
Ben Abram's and Al-Alama's threats had a profound effect on Kush. The next day, Dorian and Tahi were moved to more spacious quarters in a better part of the Zenana. Now they had their own small courtyard with a freshwater fountain. Kush sent a slave woman to help Tahi with the cooking and the heavy housework, such as changing the latrine buckets. He also sent Dorian a fresh wardrobe of clothing, and Tahi was allowed to meet the carts when they came up from the town each day, laden with fresh produce and supplies. She was able to take her pick of the fresh meat and fish. Most importantly, during the day, Dorian was allowed the run of the Zenana. However, even though he complained bitterly, Kush would not allow him to leave the walled enclosure except to visit the mullah at the fort. Even this changed when Dorian complained to Ben Abram. After that, Dorian was allowed to roam the port and the entire island, although one of Kush's guards followed him closely and never let him out of sight. So great was his freedom that Dorian started to think once again of escaping from the island. His plans were more a game of make-believe than of serious intent. When he started frequenting the beach, where the fishing boats came in to land their catches, and tried to make friends among the fisherfolk, he discovered that Kush had forestalled him. He must have warned all the islanders not to speak to the infidel. With his guard always hovering close at hand, there was not the slightest chance of stealing a boat, or of receiving any assistance from the local fishermen and sailors. Finally, Dorian resigned himself to the futility of his plans to escape. He started to devote more time and effort to making friends among the soldiers at the fort, the grooms of the royal stables, and the prince's falconers. Yasmini greeted his release from confinement with patent delight. And as soon as she divined that there was no obvious objection from Kush, she became Dorian's shadow. Of course, she was never allowed to place a foot outside the gates of the Zenana, but she followed Dorian around the gardens and was a constant visitor to the quarters he shared with Tahi. Her voice and laughter mingled with the chattering of Jinni to make the gloomy rooms seem brighter. Tahi started to teach her to cook over the smoky wood fire. This was something that Yasmini had never tried before, and she took huge delight in the novelty, and she pressed her creations on Dorian.
"I made it just for you, Dowie," she piped. "You do like it, don't you?"
Anxiously she watched each mouthful disappear.
"Is it good? Do you like it?"
When Dorian left the Zenana for his visits to the beach, the harbour and the fort, she pined. She hung around Tahi's skirts, waiting for his return, and her monkey face lit up as he walked through the door, and she ran to him. At times her devotion became so cloying that Dorian made an excuse to leave the walls of the Zenana, simply to be away from her. He would go down to the royal stables and spend hours feeding, watering, and grooming the magnificent animals of the prince's string, for the privilege of being allowed to ride one. All his instruction by his father and elder brothers at High Weald came back to him. In the cool of the evening the grooms played the game of pulo, the Persian name for a ball, which was a passion among the royal moguls and had been adopted by the Omanis. The ball was carved from a bamboo root and was struck by a mallet of the same material. When the head groom came to know Dorian better, he allowed him to join the younger boys on the practice field. Dorian loved the feel of the horses sweating back between his legs and the thundering, shouting charge down the field, elbowing and jostling the others in the melee around the ball. Soon his aggression and skill made the old Sices nod with approval. "If Allah allows, he will be a worthy horseman." One of his other favourite retreats was the royal mews, where the prince's falcons were kept. Around the fierce yet lovely birds, he was quiet and attentive, and soon the falconers accepted his interest and began to impart their lore and wisdom to him. He learned their colourful language and terminology, and sometimes, at their invitation, rode out with them when they flew the birds along the edge of the mangrove swamps at the north end of the island. At other times he would give his guard the slip and sneak away alone to explore the shores of the island, finding coves and deserted beaches where he could throw off his clothes, plunge into the ocean, and swim out over the reef, driving himself to the point of exhaustion. Then he would swim back and lie in the white sand, staring out into the south and imagining the topsails of Tom's ship coming up over the horizon. When he went back to the Zenana, where he knew Yasmini would be waiting for him, he always took a small gift with him to assuage his guilt. Sometimes it was a falcon feather from one of the molting birds, or a bangle he had plaited from horsetail hair, or seashells that he had brought up from the reef. He strung these into necklaces for her.
"I wish I could come with you," she told him wistfully. "I would love to swim with you or watch you ride the horses."
"Well, you know that you cannot," Dorian told her brusquely. He'd realised what her life would be like in the years ahead. She would never be able to leave the Zenana except veiled and chaperoned. He was probably the only friend of the opposite sex who was not a blood relative she would ever know. Even that would end soon, for both of them were on the threshold of puberty. As soon as she became a woman, she was to be married. Tahi told him that it had been arranged when Yasmini was only 4 years old. "She is to be given to one of her cousins in the land of the Great Mogul across the ocean, to cement the ties between the two royal houses." She watched the emotions that crossed Dorian's face at the thought of his little companion being sent away to a man she did not know in a land she had never seen.
"She is my sister. I don't want her to go," Dorian blurted out impulsively.
He was surprised by the strength of the responsibility he felt for her. "It will make no difference to you," Tahi told him roughly, hiding her compassion in her tone. "Within the year the change of manhood will come upon you. Kush will be watching for it. He never misses it. At the very first sign you will be banished from the Zenana forever. Even if she were to stay here, you would never see Yasmini's face again after that day. Perhaps it is best that your friendship ends as cleanly as the stroke of the knife that will celebrate your own manhood." The reference to the knife perturbed him. He had heard the other boys discussing the rite of circumcision and making crude jokes about it, but he'd never thought that he himself would have to undergo it. Now Tahi had rudely brought it home to him. "I am not a Mussulman," he protested. "They cannot do that to me." "You will never find a wife if you keep that bit of skin," she warned him. "I don't want a wife, and I don't want anyone to cut pieces off me." His fear of the blade was exacerbated by the incipient guilt he felt towards Yasmini at their enforced separation from each other. "What will she do without me to look after her?" he worried. "She is only a baby." He came home from his wanderings about the island one afternoon, just after the afternoon prayers. His hair was still damp and stiff with seawater. Tahi was squatting in front of the cooking fire, and she looked up as he stood in the doorway. With a long-suffering expression, he answered her questions as to where he had been and what he had been doing, giving her only those details that he felt she need know. Then he looked around casually. "Where's Yasmini?" he inquired, as though the answer was of no real concern. "She was here until prayers. Then she went to see Batuta, who has a new pet. I think it is a grey parrot." Dorian leaned over her shoulder and snatched one of the hot rounds of unleavened bread from the coals in front of her. She slapped his hand. "That is dinner. Put it back at once." "May the Prophet open the doors of mercy to you, Tahi." Laughing, he headed out into the gardens, breaking off pieces of bread and stuffing them into his mouth. He had a gift for Yasmini, a large spiral shell with an opalescent pink interior. He knew where to find her. There was a ruined tomb at the east side of the gardens that had been built in honour of one of the Islamic saints centuries before. There was a stone tablet on the wall of the tomb, whose text Dorian had deciphered laboriously. "Abd Allah Muhammad Ali died in the year of the Prophet 120. There was a high dome surmounted by a bronze symbol of the crescent moon, thick with verdigris. Below was an open prayer terrace that faced in the direction of the Kaaba in Mecca. At one end there was a large open rainwater system where once the faithful had performed wudu, the ritual ablutions, before prayers. Now it was disused and attracted flocks of wild birds in the afternoons. Yasmini and her special friends among her half-sisters liked to play on the terrace. Here they gossiped and bickered and played fantastic games, dressed up their pets in infants' clothing and nursed them, pretended to run a household and cook for their imaginary families. Dorian had reached the foot of the staircase that led up to the terrace when a scream from above froze him with one foot on the bottom step. Instantly he recognised Yasmini's voice. But what slashed his heart was the high-pitched agony that filled it. He sprang forward and flew up the ancient staircase, driven by a series of those terrible cries, each shriller and more chilling than the one before. Jinni, the vervet monkey, sat on the top of the dome of the old tomb. When he grew tired of being nursed and dressed like a human baby, he would escape to this favourite perch, where Yasmini could not reach him. Now he scratched under his arm sleepily, his blue eyelids drooping over his big brown eyes. Every few minutes he would sway and almost fall from his perch, then jerk awake and blink down at the garden spread below him. Suddenly he smelt something that brought him fully awake. Cinnamon cakes. There was nothing in all the world that Jinni loved more. He stood to his full height, using his long tail to balance on the rounded plaster dome, and looked around him eagerly. Two boys came down one of the paths through the shrubbery. Even from this distance, Jinni could see that their jaws were working and that the biggest of the pair carried a covered silver dish. Jinni did not need his eyes to tell him what was under the cover. He made a small, greedy, chittering sound and skipped down off the dome and swung into the top of the peepal tree, which spread its wide branches below the terrace. Hidden by the thick foliage, he watched the two boys settle down in a hidden corner of the gardens and place the silver dish between them. Zayn al-Din lifted the cover, and Jinni stiffened his tail and rolled his eyes as he saw the mound of yellow cakes. He was torn between greed and fear. He knew Zayn al-Din only too well. He had a healed scar over one eye where a stone had struck him. Zayn was an expert with a slingshot. On the other hand, the cakes were still warm from the clay oven, and their aroma was tantalizing, irresistible. Ginny shot down the trunk of the peepal, keeping it between him and the boys. When he reached the ground, he peered out from behind the tree. When he was sure he was still unobserved, he left his hiding place and darted across the lawn. From the depths of one of the shrubs, he stole another look. He puffed out his cheeks and wiggled his nose. The scent of cinnamon was much stronger here. He watched Zain lift one of the cakes to his mouth and bite into its fluffy yellow delights. Ibn al-Malik Abu Bakr was the other boy, one of Zain al-Din's numerous half-brothers. He stood up and went to one of the casuarina trees near the outer wall and pointed up into the branches. "There is a hawk nesting there," he called to Zain, who stood up and waddled across to join him. They had their backs turned to the silver dish, and their heads were thrown back as they discussed the shaggy nest in the branches high above them.
"Perhaps it is a peregrine," Zain said hopefully. "We can take the chicks when they are fledged."
Ginny gathered his courage. He shot out from under the shrub and covered the open ground in a grey streak. He reached the dish and filled both fists with the sticky cakes. He stuffed them into his mouth until his pouches bulged to the point of bursting. Half the cakes remained in the dish, and he tried to fill his paws, but he couldn't manage them all, so he dropped those he already held and started again.
"The monkey!"
Zayn's dreaded voice screeched behind him, and Ginny knew he had been discovered. In his haste to escape, he sent the dish flying and raced away back to the safety of the peepal tree. He scattered a trail of broken cinnamon cakes across the lawn behind him. As he sped up the trunk and reached the safety of the first high branch, he ducked his head and looked back. The boys were in close pursuit, shouting their protests and outrage.
"Shaitan! Devil monkey! Pig animal!"
Ginny reached the top branches and crouched in a fork. He felt safe here and started to munch the remnants of the cakes that had survived the flight and the climb up the tree. Below him, Zain opened the pouch on his belt and brought out his slingshot. He unwound the leather thongs and stretched them between spread arms. Then he selected a perfectly rounded pebble and fitted it into the pocket at the end of the double thongs. He moved around the base of the tree until he had a clear shot at Ginny. The monkey bobbed his head and opened his eyes wide, making a terrifying face to frighten him away.
"I will teach you such a lesson that you will never steal my cakes again,"
Zain promised him, and began to wind up for the throw. Round and round his head he swung the sling, building up speed until the thongs thrummed through the air, and then at that exact moment he released it. The pebble was a hissing white blur, too swift for Ginny to dodge. It struck the monkey's left arm below the elbow, and the bone snapped. Ginny screeched and sprang high in the air, his broken arm flapping. As he came down, he tried to grab at a branch, but the arm would not respond, and he tumbled halfway down the tree before he could catch hold with his right paw. The two boys were shouting and dancing with excitement.
"You hit him, Zain," Abu Bakr exulted. "I will kill you, you thieving shaitan!"
Zain was fitting another stone into the pocket of the sling. Ginny clawed his way single arm back up the tree. He was whining and gibbering with pain as he reached the long branch that extended out over the terrace. Zain launched the next stone, which sang through the air and hit the branch just under Ginny's chest. He sprang in the air and raced towards the end of the branch, with his broken arm dangling and swinging. He knew where he could find protection. Yasmini had heard his screams, and though she did not know what had caused them, she was calling him urgently.
"Ginny, what is it, my baby? Come to your mama."
From the end of the branch, Ginny launched himself and dropped into Yasmini's arms, sobbing and chittering with pain and terror.
"Come," Zain shouted at Abu Bakr. "Find a stick. We will finish him off."
At the foot of the staircase, the gardeners had left a pile of bamboo stakes. Each of the boys grabbed one and ran up the staircase. Puffing and laughing, Zain was the first to reach the terrace. He stopped short when Yasmini confronted him with Ginny in her arms.
"Don't come near me," she yelled at him. "Leave us alone, Zain al-Din."
For a moment, Zain was disconcerted by the fury of the small girl. But then Abu Bakr came up behind him and pushed him forward.
"It's only Yasmini. She is a baby. I will hold her. You grab the monkey."
Yasmini retreated before them, clutching the terrified animal to her chest, but they followed her threateningly, brandishing the bamboo stakes, egging each other on.
"The shaitan stole my cakes. I am going to kill him." "I will kill you first,"
Yasmini shouted back at him. But her show of bravery was starting to crumble, and tears welled in her eyes. She came up against the low wall of the rainwater cistern and stood there, trapped and desperate. Her half-sisters had deserted her and run off at the first sign of trouble from their elder brother. Yasmini was alone. Her lips quivered, but she tried to keep her voice strong.
"Leave us alone. I will tell Al-Amhara. He will punish you for what you have done to Jinni."
Zain jeered.
"You will tell Al-Amhara? You frighten me. Al-Amhara is a pig-eating infidel."
They crowded her up against the cistern. Suddenly Abu Bakr jumped forward and grabbed her around the neck.
"Get the monkey,"
he shouted, and Zain seized Jinni by the leg. The three struggled and staggered around the terrace, fighting over the screeching animal. Yasmini was clinging to Jinni with all her strength, screaming through her tears. Abu Bakr prized her fingers free, one at a time, until she lost her grip and Zain snatched the monkey from her.
"Give him back," she pleaded. "Please don't hurt him any more."
Zain held Jinni up by the scruff of the neck.
"Come and get him then before I kill the filthy thing."
Suddenly Jinni twisted in his grip and sank his teeth into Zain's wrist. Zain let out a howl of pain and surprise, lifted Jinni over his head and hurled him into the rainwater cistern. The monkey disappeared beneath the water, then splashed to the surface and swam to the edge. Zain held up his bleeding wrist and stared at it. Then his sallow face darkened with fury.
"He bit me. Look at the blood."
He ran to the edge of the cistern, reached out with the bamboo stake and pushed Jinni's head under the water. As soon as it bobbed up again, he thrust it under once more, now hooting with sadistic joy.
"Let us see how well it can swim."
Yasmini tore herself out of Abu Bakr's grip and jumped onto Zain's back. She screamed as she pummeled his head and shoulders. Zain kept on hooting and jeering, taking no notice of her screams and her attack. He went on drowning Jinni, ducking his head every time it reappeared. Jinni was weakening swiftly and sneezing water, his fur sodden and clinging to his skull. He no longer had the strength or the air in his lungs to scream, but Yasmini's voice rang louder and shriller.
"Leave him! I hate you! Leave my baby!"
Dorian raced up the last few steps and stopped to the top of the staircase. It took him a moment to grasp the meaning of the confused scene before him. He had been overtaken by a wild panic at the prospect of finding Yasmini badly injured and dying, but his fear gave way to cold anger as he saw what the two big boys were doing to her and Jinni. He launched himself at them. Abu Bakr saw him coming and spun round to face him. He lifted the bamboo to hit at his head, but Dorian ducked under the swing and crashed his shoulder into the centre of the other boy's chest, sending him reeling away. Abu Bakr struck the side wall of the terrace and dropped the bamboo. Then he turned and fled to the head of the staircase and disappeared down it. Dorian's only concern now was to get at Zain and rescue Yasmini. He flew at him, and Zain turned to meet him. But he was hampered by the small girl straddling his back, and his swing with the bamboo was clumsy. Dorian blocked it and seized the stake with both hands. They stumbled in a circle, both tugging and heaving at the stake.
"Get Jinni,"
Dorian gasped at Yasmini, and obediently she jumped down off Zain's back and ran to the cistern. She reached in and grabbed the monkey as he floundered weakly. She dragged him out, sopping wet, coughing and sneezing water from his mouth and nose. She held him to her chest and crouched below the parapet of the cistern, trying to avoid the two boys who were struggling and pushing each other around the terrace. Zain was heavier than Dorian and taller by 2 inches. He was starting to dominate the straight trial of strength.
"I am going to drown you just like the monkey, you devil-eyed infidel,"
he threatened, and heaved with all his weight on the bamboo stave. In his fury, Dorian had forgotten everything that Tom had ever taught him. But now the insult steadied him, and he let Zain pull him in close. Then he released his grip on the stave and bunched his right fist. He shifted his feet, anchoring himself. "Use the turn of the body and the swing of the shoulders," Tom had coached him. "Go for the nose." Dorian launched the punch. his hands hardened by riding and his shoulders conditioned by swimming. He caught Zayn flush on the nose, which squashed like an overripe plum in a flood of scarlet juice. Zayn dropped the bamboo and clutched with both hands at his injured face. His eyes flooded with tears of pain, and blood ran from between his fingers and dripped onto his white kanzu. Dorian set himself up for the next punch. Tom had shown him how to find the point of the jaw, making him clench his teeth and feel for it under his own ear. Dorian let the next punch go, with all his weight coming in behind it. Zayn had never heard of this kind of fighting. Making a hammer out of the hand and using it to beat in an opponent's face was something alien to his idea of combat. He had been taught to wrestle, but enjoyed it only when matched against a lighter, weaker boy. The blow to his nose had flabbergasted him, the surprise even more crippling than the pain. He was unprepared for the next blow. It felt like a cannonball into the side of his face, and his senses tottered. Dorian did not yet have the weight or power to drop him senseless, but the punch struck exactly where he had aimed, and with enough force to send Zayn reeling backwards, unable to see through his streaming eyes, unable to defend himself, his legs turning boneless under him. Then, to Zayn's bewilderment, there came another blow, slamming into his fat lips. He felt one of his front teeth break off, and the warm metallic taste of his own blood filled his mouth. With both arms covering his face, he stumbled blindly to the head of the stairs. Behind him, Dorian picked up the bamboo and belaboured his back and shoulders. Even through the pain of his mouth and nose, the sting of the bamboo made Zayn leap forward onto the top step. Dorian swung the cane again, and Zayn yelled as though he had been stung by a scorpion and lost his footing. He went rolling in a tangle of arms and legs to the bottom, and crawled away, sobbing wildly. Then he heard Dorian rushing down the stairs behind him and looked back over his shoulder through swimming eyes. The infidel's face was contorted into a crimson mask of fury. Those pale green eyes were blazing, and he had the bamboo held high in both hands. Zayn hauled himself to his feet and spat out the broken tooth in a spray of blood. He tried to run, but something was broken in his right foot, and he hopped, limped, and lumbered away across the lawn in pursuit of the fleeing Abu Bakr. Dorian dropped the bamboo and let them go. He took a few deep breaths to bring his rage under control, then thought of the little girl. He ran back up the steps. Yasmini was still crouched under the parapet. She was shaking and sobbing and holding the sodden body of the monkey to her chest. "Are you hurt, Yasmini? Did he hurt you?" She shook her head, and wordlessly held Ginny out towards him. The monkey's fur was soaked and flattened against his body, so that he appeared to be half his normal size, as though the skin had been flayed off him. "His arm," Yasmini whispered. "It's broken." Dorian took the dangling limb gently between his finger, and Ginny whimpered, but did not resist. He watched Dorian with huge, trusting eyes. Dorian tried to remember all he had learned from watching Dr. Reynolds working with the injuries of a sailor who had fallen from the rigging of the Seraph, and another who had caught his arm in the spinning bars of the capstan. He straightened Ginny's arm gently, using a short length of bamboo to secure it in that position, then bound it up with a strip of cotton torn from his kefir headcloth. "I must take him to Ben Abram," he told Yasmini, and lifted the small body out of her arms.
"I wish I could come with you," she whispered.
But she knew that was not possible, and Dorian did not bother to reply. He made a cradle for Ginny out of a fold of his robe. Yasmini came with him as far as the gates of the Zenana, and stood staring after him as he trotted off down the road through the palm groves, heading for the town. Within half a mile he caught up with one of the grooms from the stables, leading a string of the prince's horses.
"Mustafa," he shouted, "give me a ride as far as the harbour."
Mustafa took him up on the back of his mount, and they galloped through the narrow streets of the town down to the seafront. Ben Abram was at work in his infirmary near the harbour. He came through from the small back room, scrubbing blood from his hands, and greeted Dorian and Ginny with astonishment.
"I have brought you a patient, old father,
"'One who is in sore need of your great skills,' Dorian told him. "'Will the beast bite me?' Ben Abram peered at Ginny suspiciously.
"'Have no fear. Ginny knows he can trust you.'
"'The setting of bones is a skill that goes back to antiquity,' Ben Abram remarked as he peered closely at the limb. "'But I doubt any of my forebears had such a patient as this.' When he had finished and the limb was splintered and bandaged, Ben Abram gave Ginny a draught of laudanum, and the monkey slept in Dorian's arms for all the long walk back to the Zenana. Yasmini was waiting for them just inside the gate. She took the drugged monkey out of Dorian's arms and carried him tenderly to the living quarters, where they found Tahi in a tearful turmoil of worry.
"'What have you done, you stupid boy?' she attacked Dorian the instant he put his head through the doorway. "'The whole Zenana is in an uproar!' Kush has been here. He is in such a terrible rage that he can hardly speak. Is it true that Genie has bitten Zain al-Din, and that you have broken his tooth and smashed his nose, and that the bone in his foot is broken? Kush says that Zain may never be able to walk again. At the least he will be crippled for life. He broke his foot with his own clumsiness. Dorian was defiant and unrepentant. And Tahi seized him and hugged him to her ample bosom. She broke down and wept loudly. "'You do not know what danger you have brought on your own head,' she sobbed. "'From now onwards we must always be on the watch. "'You must never eat or drink anything that I have not tasted first. "'You must keep the bar on the door to your sleeping chamber.' "'She reeled off the list of precautions that they would take "'against the vengeance of Kush and Zain al-Din. "'Allah only knows what the prince will think of this when he returns from Muscat.' "'She ended her tirade with a morbid relish.' Yasmini and Dorian left her wailing and dreaming of horrors over her kitchen pots and carried Ginny through to Dorian's bedchamber. They laid him on the sleeping mat and sat over him side by side. Neither spoke, but after a while Yasmini drooped like a fading blossom and fell asleep against Dorian's shoulder. He put his arm around her, and much later Tahi found them asleep in each other's arms. She knelt beside the pair and studied their faces. They are so beautiful together, so young and so innocent. What a great pity that it can never be. They might have had red-haired children, she whispered, and lifted Yasmini out of Dorian's protective arms to carry her back to her own mother's splendid quarters near the main gate, where she handed her over to one of the nurses. Kush came again, early the following morning, full of bluster and threats. Despite these, it was apparent that he was not prepared to flout the strictures of Al-Alama and Ben Abraham, and to bring any real harm to Dorian, but his malevolence shimmered around him like an aura of evil. At the door he looked back at Dorian, his swollen features filled with hatred. "'The day will soon come, if Allah is kind, when you will no longer be here in the Zenana to trouble me.' The atmosphere crackled like summer lightning with hostility towards Dorian. The other children, all except Yasmini, kept well away from him. As soon as they saw him, they broke off their rowdy games and scuttled away, tittering. The women covered their faces and drew the skirts of their robes aside, as though contact with him would contaminate them. 3 days later, he met Zain as he came back through the gates from his lessons with Al-Alama. Zain was sitting with Abu Bakr and 3 other toadies. They were feasting on a dish of sweetmeats, but they fell silent as Dorian walked down the cloisters towards them and watched him uneasily. Zain's nose was still swollen, and there was a black scab on his upper lip. Both his eye sockets were bruised even darker than their natural colour. His right foot was wrapped in bandages. Perhaps it was true that he might be crippled for life, Dorian thought, but he never faltered, and he stared directly at Zain. The bigger boy could not hold that cold green stare and turned away. He said something to Abu Bakr, and both boys giggled nervously. Dorian strode past them, and Zain grew bolder as he walked away. "'Skin white as pus,' he said, and his breath whistled through the gap in his front teeth. "'Eyes green as pig's pea,' Abu Bakr agreed. "'Only one who drinks it would know the colour so well,' Dorian said as loudly, and walked on without looking back. Over the following weeks, the feeling of dangerous hostility subsided. Though Dorian had become the outcast of the Zenana, now the others simply ignored him.
Even Zayn and Abu Bakr no longer reacted to his presence, but behaved with exaggerated nonchalance whenever they met. Zayn was still limping, and over time it became clear that the damage to his right foot might indeed be permanent. However, Tahi was not placated by the hostile truce between the two boys, and she missed no opportunity to lecture Dorian on the dangers of exposing himself to poison or other macabre methods of dealing death at a distance. "Always shake out your kunzu before donning it. Turn over your sandals. There is a small green scorpion that kills so swiftly that the victim does not have time to cry out after its sting. Kush knows well the ways of the scorpion and all the other evil things." But none of this could dampen Dorian's naturally ebullient spirits for long. He spent less and less time within the walls of the Zenana. When he was there, Yasmini was his constant companion. As a credit to Ben Abram's skills, Ginny recovered rapidly, and though he favoured the undamaged limb, he was soon scampering along the top of the outer wall, or scaling the highest branches of the peepal trees. The long month of Ramadan came, and then the new moon ended the fast. Within days, Zayn al-Din was gone from the Zenana. He had reached puberty and manhood, and still limping from the injury Dorian had inflicted on him, had entered the outside world. Dorian and Yasmini rejoiced at his departure. They heard that he had been sent to Muscat to join the court of his uncle, the Caliph. Tahi sniffed when they told her. "He has been sent as a hostage to the Caliph to ensure the obedience of the prince." This was not the first that Dorian had heard of the intrigues within the Omani royal family. However, Tahi repeated what he knew already. "The Caliph has executed 6 of his brothers for treason, and he does not trust those he has spared." She dropped her voice to a whisper. "The Caliph is a cruel, evil man. Allah forbid that you should ever come to his notice as the child of the prophecy." She shivered at the thought. A few weeks after Zayn al-Din's abrupt departure, Yasmini came to Dorian's quarters before he was awake and shook his arm urgently.
"Ginny did not come for his food last night, and he was not in my bed this morning."
She was drawn and shaky from grief and worry. Dorian jumped up and flung on his kunzu, while Yasmini lamented.
"I think something terrible has happened to my Ginny."
"We will find him," Dorian promised her. "Come on." They started with all the most likely places, Ginny's favourite haunts. The chief of these was the tomb of the saint, Abd Allah Muhammad Ali. They searched every inch of the ancient structure, calling Ginny's name and offering cinnamon cakes. They knew that if anything would, the aroma would bring him out of any hiding place. When they failed there, they went systematically through the gardens, but with the same lack of success. By this time, Yasmini was beside herself with grief.
"You saved him once, Dawi. Now Shaitan has come back for him again. He may have taken him away as a punishment."
"Don't be a baby, Yasi."
Unconsciously, he used the same words with which Tom had chided him.
"Shaitan does not concern himself with monkeys and small females."
"What are we going to do?"
Yasmini turned those haunted, honey-coloured eyes on him with absolute trust.
"We'll start again at the tomb.
Ginny must be somewhere." The entrance to the tomb had been bricked and plastered closed centuries before, and though Dorian examined it minutely, there was no hole through which even a monkey could pass. They went up onto the terrace and searched that again. Though they called until they were hoarse, there was still no sign of Ginny. At last they sat in despair on the edge of the cistern and avoided each other's eyes, tired and dispirited. If they had not been absolutely silent, they would never have heard the faint chittering. They heard it at the same time, and Yasmini seized Dorian's arm, sinking her sharp little nails into his skin.
"Ginny!"
she whispered. They jumped down from the cistern and stared about eagerly, their tiredness forgotten. The sound seemed to emanate in the air around them, without any focal point.
"Where is it coming from, Dawi?"
Yasmini asked. But he shushed her imperiously. Holding up a hand for silence, he tracked the faint sound across the terrace. When it stopped, he whistled. And immediately Ginny called again, leading him to the far end. There they seemed to reach a dead end, until Dorian went down on his knees and crawled along the juncture of the dome wall and the skirting of the terrace, where Ginny's cries were perceptibly louder. Weeds and creepers blanketed the area. But he picked out a track through them that looked as though somebody or something had recently passed that way. He moved in, bending the weeds aside and lifting the dangling creepers to inspect the base of the dome wall. He saw at once that the coral rag had disintegrated at one point, and that there was an aperture large enough for Ginny to have squeezed through. When he put his ear to this opening, his last doubts were dispelled. Ginny's cries were magnified as though by a speaking tube. "He's down there," he told Jasmini. She clapped her hands joyfully. "Can you get him out, Dowie?" Then she placed her mouth to the hole and shouted down it, "Ginny, my baby, can you hear me?" She was answered by faint but excited squeaks from the depths of the hole. "Get out of the way." Dorian pushed her aside and began to work at enlarging the hole with his bare hands. The ragging was unmortared, and chunks of it came away in his hands. He sent Yasmini to bring him one of the bamboo staves from the pile at the bottom of the steps, and used this to prise out the more stubborn chunks of brick. Within half an hour he'd enlarged the opening enough so that he could squeeze through. However, when he peered down into the depths, all he could see was the swirling dust of his labours and darkness. "Wait here, Yassi," he ordered, and lowered his legs into the opening. Although he kicked around, he was unable to touch the bottom or find a foothold. He clung to the lip with both hands and let himself down an inch at a time. Abruptly, the section of the wall he was holding broke away, and with a shout of alarm, he fell into the dark. He expected to plunge down hundreds of feet to his death, but he dropped only inches before he hit the ground. The impact was so unexpected that his legs gave way under him, and he fell in a heap. He scrambled up. Yasmini called down urgently, "Are you all right, Dowie?"
"Yes."
"Can I come down?"
"No, you stay there. Take your head out of the way to let the light in."
When the dust had settled and his eyes became accustomed to the gloom, he surveyed his surroundings. A faint ray of sunlight came from the opening above him, and by its light he found himself in a narrow passage, which seemed to have been built into the centre of the massive outer wall of the tomb. It was just wider than his shoulders, and high enough for him to stand upright. Jeannie's cries came from close at hand, and he moved towards them, sneezing. Dorian found a wooden door which shut off the passage. It was crumbling with age and damp mould, and it had fallen off its rotten leather hinges. Ginny must have swung on it, and even his small bulk had been enough to bring it down. Now he was trapped under it. He had torn his fingernails on the wood trying to free himself, and his fur was thick with dust and wood chips. Dorian tugged and heaved at the heavy door, lifting it enough for the monkey to wriggle out from under it. Ginny was not injured, and he shot up Dorian's body and onto his shoulder, where he clung to his neck with both arms chattering with relief. "You stupid animal," Dorian scolded in English as he stroked Ginny's head to quieten him. "This will teach you not to go wandering off where you should not go, you idiot monkey." He carried him back and handed him up to Yasmini, who was hanging head and shoulders through the hole. Then he went back, lifted one end of the door and dragged it back. He leaned it against the wall of the passage and used it as a ladder to climb back through the opening into the sunlight. He was covered with dust and dirt, so while Yasmini smothered Ginny in a loving embrace, he washed away the worst of the filth in the waters of the system. Yasmini carried Ginny down the steps, but before he followed them, Dorian went back on an impulse and arranged the weeds and the flowering creeper to conceal the hole in the base of the dome. It was some days later that Dorian went back to explore the further reaches of the secret passage. He should never have told Yasmini what he planned, for she insisted on coming with him and bringing Ginny. Without letting Tahi know, Dorian took one of the lamps and a steel and flint to light it. They went through elaborate precautions to make certain that they were not followed by any of Kush's spies or henchmen, taking separate routes to the old tomb and meeting beside the cistern. "Nobody followed you?" Dorian demanded, as Yasmini scuttled up the stairs with Ginny riding on her shoulder. "Nobody," she confirmed, almost dancing with excitement. "What do you think we will find, Dowie? A great treasure of gold and jewels?" "A secret room full of skulls and old bones," he said, teasing. She looked apprehensive. "Will you go first?" she asked, and took his hand. They crept into the weeds and pulled them close behind them. Then Dorian lifted the creepers from the entrance to the passage and peered into the darkness.
It's safe. Nobody has found it. He squatted and worked with the flint and steel.
When the lamp flame was burning evenly, he said, "Pass it down to me when I tell you." He lowered himself into the opening and looked up. "Give me the lamp." He took it from her hands and set it out of the way. "Now come down." He guided her dangling feet, placing them on the old door. "You're nearly there. Jump." She hopped down and looked about her. Jeanie came darting after her and shot up her leg. There was not enough headroom for him to ride on her shoulder, so she took him on her hip.
"This is so exciting. I have never done anything like this before."
"Don't make so much noise." Dorian picked up the lamp. "Now stay close behind me, but don't get in my way." He moved cautiously to where the old door had stood, but felt a slide of disappointment when he saw that the passage had been bricked shut only a few yards further on. It was a dead end.
"What is beyond the bricks?"
Yasmini asked in a whisper. "It looks as if it once led into the tomb itself, but somebody closed it off. I wonder why they built it anyway."
"So that the angel Gibral could come into the tomb to take the soul of the saint to paradise," Yasmini told him with authority. "Gibral always comes down to fetch the souls of righteous men."
Dorian was on the point of ridiculing her when he saw how large and liquid her eyes looked in the light of the lamp.
"Perhaps you're right," he agreed. "But I wonder where the other end of the passage leads to."
They turned, passing under the opening through which they had entered, and went on slowly into the dusty darkness, which smelt of fungus and mould. In the feeble yellow lamplight, the floor beneath their feet began to slope downwards, and every few paces there were stone steps descending. The roof was only inches above Dorian's head.
"I am frightened," Yasmini whispered breathlessly. "Perhaps the angel will be angry with us for using his road."
She hugged Ginny close to her chest. With her other hand, she reached out and took a firm grip on the back of Dorian's kunzel. They moved on quietly. The passage continued to angle downwards until Dorian guessed that they were well below ground level. Then it levelled out and ran straight. He counted the paces.
"What happens if the roof falls in?"
Yasmini asked.
"It's been here for hundreds of years," Dorian said confidently. "Why would it suddenly fall in now?"
He went on, counting the paces aloud.
322, he announced, then said almost immediately, "Look, there are steps going up again."
They climbed them slowly. Dorian paused on each tread and held the lamp high to survey the way ahead. Suddenly he stopped again.
"It's blocked," he said with heavy disappointment.
In the lamplight they saw that the roof and one of the side walls had fallen in. They stood uncertainly, staring at the tumbled masonry. Suddenly, Ginny jumped down from Yasmini's hip and darted forward. Before Dorian could grab his tail, he disappeared into a small opening between the intact part of the roof and the pile of rubble.
"Ginny!"
Yasmini pushed past Dorian and thrust her arm into the opening. "He will get stuck again. Save him, Dowie."
"Stupid monkey."
Dorian started clearing the masonry and trying to reach inside. Every few minutes they heard Ginny calling, but he would not come back to Yasmini, though she pleaded with him. Dorian worked on doggedly, clearing the rubbish from the tunnel ahead. Then he stopped and climbed onto the heap.
"I can see light ahead."
He was jubilant. He jumped down and redoubled his efforts to clear away the rubble that still blocked the tunnel. An hour later he wiped his face on the hem of his kunzu. His sweat had mingled with the dust into a paste of mud.
"I think I can crawl through now."
He worked his way belly down into the enlarged opening, and apprehensively Yasmini watched his body, then his legs, and finally his feet disappear from view. Moments later he called,
"Yassi, it's all right, come on."
She was so much smaller than him that she could crawl on hands and knees. Within a short distance the light strengthened, and she found Dorian squatting at the exit to the tunnel. A veil of vegetation hung down in front of them. But beyond that was brilliant sunlight.
"Where are we?"
she asked, crowding in beside him.
"I don't know."
Cautiously he parted the green foliage. They were in a saucer of ground, surrounded by fallen walls of coral bricks, disintegrated by time and weather.
The whole area was heavily overgrown.
Stay there, Dorian told her, and crept out into the sunlight.
Gingerly he climbed to the top of the ruin and looked out. He saw palm trees and green mangrove forest, and beyond that a glimpse of white beach and the vivid blue ocean. He recognized the area from his explorations outside the walls.
"We are outside the Zenana," he said with astonishment. "The tunnel goes under the wall." "I have never been outside in my whole life." Yasmini climbed up beside him. "Look, is that the beach? Can't we go down there, Dowie?"
They heard voices and ducked down. A party of women passed below their hiding place without looking up. They were Swahili slave girls, black and unveiled, with huge bundles of firewood balanced on their heads. They passed, and their voices faded.
"Can we go down to the beach, Dowie?" Yasmini pleaded. "For only a short time, just this once."
"No, you're a silly girl," Dorian said sternly. "The fishermen will see us, and they'll tell Kush. Then there'll be another grave in the cemetery. You know what happens to little girls who defy him." He scrambled back into the mouth of the tunnel. "Come on."
"Perhaps it is the will of God that I should never swim in the ocean with you," she said wistfully, still gazing down through the trees. "Come down, Yassi. We must go back."
Her words troubled him. Every time he went down to the beach by himself and swam out over the reef, he felt guilty. And though she did not mention it again, her appeal preyed upon his mind. Over the weeks that followed, he quietly scouted the area outside the east wall of the Zenana and found that there were many overgrown ruins among the trees. They were mostly covered with undergrowth, or by the sand dunes blown up from the beach by the monsoon. It took him some days to find the exact clump of bushes and old coral rag that hid the mouth of the tunnel. When he was certain that he was not being watched, he climbed over the heap and down to the opening in its saucer. He spent several hours working to clear the entrance so that access was easier and safer, then covered it again with fallen palm fronds and dried branches to hide it from casual discovery by the Swahili woodgatherers. From his friends Mustafa, the groom at the stables, he begged a grubby, tattered kanzu, more patches than original material, and an equally filthy kathia, which even the groom would no longer wear. He rolled these into a bundle and hid it in the exit of the tunnel. He waited until the moon was full, and then, when all was ready, he asked Yasmini, "Would you really like to swim in the ocean?" She stared at him in astonishment, and then her small face crumpled. "Don't tease me, Dowie," she pleaded. "This evening you will come to eat dinner with Tahi and me. After the Maghrib prayers, you will thank Tahi and tell her that you are going back to your mother. Instead, you will come here and hide behind the cistern." Slowly her face lit up and her eyes sparkled. "Your mother will think you are with Tahi, and Tahi will think you are with your mother. I will follow you shortly and find you here."
"Yes, Dowie," she nodded vigorously.
"You will not be frightened to come here in the dark on your own?"
"No, Dowie."
She shook her head so vehemently that it seemed she might loosen it from her shoulders.
"You cannot bring Ginny. He must stay in his cage. Do you promise me?" "I promise you with all my heart, Dowie."
At dinner, Yasmini was so restless and talkative that Tahi studied her shrewdly. "What ails you, child? You're jabbering like a flock of parakeets and bouncing around as though you have a hot coal in your trousers. Have you been out in the sun again without a covering on your head?"
Yasmini gobbled down the last of the meal, scooping it from the bowl with the fingers of her right hand. Then she jumped up. "I must go, Tahi. My mother charged me to return early."
"You have not finished your food. I have your favourite, grated coconut cakes with saffron."
"I am not hungry tonight. I must go. I will come again tomorrow."
"Your prayers first," Tahi restrained her.
"All praise and thanks to the Almighty Allah for having given us to eat and drink and having made of us Muslims,"
Yasmini gabbled and sprang to her feet. She was out of the room before Tahi could stop her again. Dorian waited a short time, then stood up and stretched nonchalantly.
"I'm going for a walk in the gardens."
Immediately Tahi was all concern. "Remember to be very careful, Al-Amhara. Do not think that Kush has forgiven you." Dorian retreated swiftly to avoid any further advice.
"Yassi," he called softly,
as he crept up the staircase to the terrace. His voice quavered and cracked. It had been playing tricks on him for a while now, in moments of nervousness or emotion, jumping up and down the scale.
"Yassi!"
This time it came out gruffly.
"Dowie, I'm here."
She crawled out from behind the cistern and ran to meet him. The moon was just rising above the outer wall of the Zenana, and by its light Dorian led her to the opening to the Angel's Road, as they had named their secret passage. He lowered himself into it and found the lamp, the flint and steel, where he had left them. When the wick was burning evenly, he called Yasmini down and caught her small body as she came sliding down the old door. She pressed close behind him, hanging on to the back of his robe, as he led her along the tunnel. When they reached the collapsed section that he had cleared, Dorian snuffed out the wick of the lamp.
"You must not show any light," he warned her.
They groped their way along the wall for the last few yards, and at last they could see the luminescence of the moon through the trailing creepers that masked the exit of the tunnel. Dorian searched for the bundle of old clothes he had hidden in a niche in the tunnel wall.
"Here, put these on," he ordered.
"They are smelly," she protested.
"Do you want to come out with me or not?"
She did not argue again, but there was the rustle of cloth as she stripped off her own clothes and pulled the kanzu over her head.
"I am ready,"
she said eagerly. He led her out into the moonlight. The robe was too big for her. She tripped over the skirts. He knelt in front of her and ripped away the hem at the level of her ankles, then helped her arrange the keffia over her head to hide her long hair.
"That will do," he said as he looked her over.
She looked like any one of the ragged urchins that ran wild through the streets of the town or along the beaches. The son of a fisherman, perhaps, or one of the gatherers of firewood or mangrove bark. "Come on." They scrambled out of the ruins, and then, with exaggerated caution, crept down through the palm groves to the head of the beach. Dorian knew this stretch of coast intimately. He had chosen a spot where low sandstone cliffs screened a tidal pool. In the face of the cliff there was a shallow cave, which was filled with shadows that hid them as they sat side by side on the hard-packed, damp sand. They looked out on the silvery, moon-bathed cove. The tide was out, and the coral sand was exposed. It was purest white, and the moon shadows of the sculpted sandstone pillars were cast stark and blue on its flat, unmarked sands. The low surf on the outer reef glowed with phosphorescence, which lit up their faces intermittently.
"It's beautiful," Yasmini whispered. "I would never have believed how beautiful."
"I'm going to swim," Dorian said, and stood up. He pulled off his kanzu and kicked away his sandals.
"Are you coming?"
Without waiting for an answer, he walked out onto the beach. At the edge of the pool, he turned and looked back. Yasmini emerged from the cave, moving like a fawn from the covert, on legs that seemed too long for her childlike body. She had shed the tattered robe and was as naked as he. Dorian had seen slave girls on the blocks in the market, but none had possessed this fairy grace. Her hair hung down her back to her small rounded buttocks. The streak through the sable hair was silver in the moonlight. When she reached him, she put out her hand in an innocent gesture and took his. Her creamy breast buds were barely defined, delicate swellings, but the little nipples stood proud, teased by the cool airs of the monsoon. He stared at them, and they made him feel strange, an unaccustomed tightness in the pit of his stomach. Hand in hand they stepped into the pool. The water was warmer than the night air, warm as their own blood. Yasmini sank down into it until her long hair floated out around her like the leaves of the water lotus, and she laughed with joy. The moon was halfway to its zenith when at last he told her, "We must not stay here longer. It grows late. We must go back."
"I have never been so happy," she said. "Never in my life. I wish we could stay like this forever."
But she stood up obediently, and the silvery water gilded her long, slim limbs. They walked back up the beach and left their footprints like a double string of beads on the pale sand. At the mouth of the cave she turned to him.
"Thank you, Dowie."
Then suddenly she threw both her arms around him and hugged him.
"I love you so much, my brother."
Dorian stood awkwardly in her embrace. The feeling of her small body against him, the warmth of her skin through the cool drops of seawater,
gave him that strange feeling again in the pit of his stomach. She stepped back and giggled.
I am all wet.
She took a hank of her thick, dark hair and twisted it. The water dripped from it onto the sand. Dorian picked up his kunzu from where he had dropped it. Turn around, he said. And obediently she offered him the slim curve of her back. He dried it roughly, scrubbing it with the folds of his robe. The other side now. She turned to face him, and he wiped the cloth over those small warm swellings on her chest, then down over her belly.
That tickles.
Her stomach was smooth and concave, the only blemish upon it the puckering of her navel, and at its base the little vertical cleft of hairless skin between her thighs. Now put on your kunzu, he ordered, and she turned and picked up the garment off the sand. He saw that her buttocks were small and perfectly rounded. He felt his chest constricted, and he drew the next breath with difficulty. She straightened up and dropped the dirty kunzu over her head, and as she pushed her head out through the opening, he was still standing staring at her. She gave him a pixie smile. Then, while she wound her hair into a thick rope and pushed it under the keffiyeh, she studied his body openly and without any sense of guilt or sin.
You are so white where the sun has not touched you, and look, you have hair down there also, she pointed with surprise. It is the same colour as on your head. It sparkles like silk in the moonlight. It is pretty, she marvelled.
He had forgotten the soft fuzz that had sprouted over the past months. For the first time he felt shy, almost guilty in front of her, and swiftly he covered himself with his own damp robe. We must go, he said, and she had to run to catch up with him as he headed back towards the zenana. In the safety of the tunnel she shed the grubby kunzu and changed back into her own clothing.
Are you ready?
Dorian asked.
Yes, Dowie.
But before he could start down the tunnel, she grabbed his hand.
Thank you, my brother, she whispered. I will never forget what we did tonight. Never, never.
He tried to untangle her grip on his hand. His emotions confused him, and he felt almost angry with her for causing him to feel this way.
Can we come again, Dowie? She pleaded.
I don't know. He pulled his hand free.
Perhaps. Please, Dowie, it was so much fun.
Well, then we'll have to see.
It will be so good. I will do anything you say. I won't tease you or cheek you ever again. Just say yes, please, Dowie.
All right, Yassi. We'll come again. A few days after their foray down the Angel's Road, and before Dorian could make good his promise to take her again, Kush came to his living quarters. He appeared in the early morning, before the sun had risen, and with him were two of his eunuch slaves. Tahi met them at the door and tried to prevent them entering.
"What do you want with Al-Amhara?" she demanded.
"Stand aside, you old cow," Kush ordered. "The boy is no longer your charge."
"You have come to take him from me?"
Her voice quivered, and she snatched at his embroidered waistcoat as he tried to push past her.
"Stand back, I warned you."
He drove the butt of his staff into her belly, and she doubled over with pain.
"Bring out the infidel!"
Kush ordered his two slaves, and they rushed into Dorian's small chamber. He was sitting on his mat, rudely wakened by Kush's penetratingly high tones from the room next door. Rubbing the sleep out of his eyes, the eunuchs grabbed his arms and dragged him through to where Kush waited.
"Take that off!"
Kush pointed with his staff at the kikoi cloth knotted around Dorian's hips. They pulled it off, and Kush grinned lasciviously.
"I thought so. A nice little garden you have growing there."
With the tip of his staff, he prodded the nest of fluffy red-gold curls that now covered Dorian's mons pubis. Dorian tried to cover himself, but they forced him upright.
"It is time for this to come off,"
he prodded Dorian with one fat, beringed finger.
"We will rid you of this smelly piece of skin."
"Don't touch me,"
Dorian shouted furiously, his voice cracking, his cheeks flushing bright scarlet with anger and humiliation.
"Take your fat white hands off me, you thing with no balls."
The smirk dropped from Kush's lips, and he jerked his hand away.
"Say your salams to this old cow,"
he glared at Tahi.
You will see her no more. My fellows will wait with you while you pack your possessions. You are leaving the Zenana. The knife awaits you, and a new life thereafter.
At the door, Tahi clung to him.
You are the son I could never have, she whispered. I will love you all my life. And I'll love you also, Tahi. I cannot remember my own mother, but she must have been like you. Be a man and a warrior, Al-Amkhara. Make me proud. Tell Yasmini, he broke off.
What message could he send the little one? While he pondered it, the slaves pulled him out through the door. Desperately, he called back to Tahi.
Tell Yasmini I will never forget her. Tell her she will always be my little sister.
The slaves took him out to where the bullock cart waited in the front courtyard of the Zenana. A small crowd of children and women servants had gathered to watch him go, but Yasmini was not among them, although he looked for her as they rolled out through the gates. It is always more difficult and dangerous when the boy is older, Ben Abram observed. This should have been done much earlier, not at 13, when he is on the threshold of manhood.
The boy comes from the world of the infidel, and he is in a state of abomination until the ritual is performed. It must be done before the return of the prince from Muscat, Al-Alama replied. If he is verily of the prophecy, then Allah will protect the boy.
Dorian stood naked before them. They were on the terrace of the palace, overlooking the harbour. Apart from the doctor and the holy mullah, there was a young black slave girl with them, a pagan, who could not be defiled by assisting Ben Abram. Ben Abram laid out his instruments on the low table, then looked straight into Dorian's eyes. Pain is nothing to a man. Honour is everything. Remember that all your life, my son.
I will not fail, old father, Dorian replied.
They had discussed this many times before.
Bismillah hi Allahu Akbar, Ben Abram said quietly. I begin in the name of Almighty God. Allah is great.
At the same time, the mullah began to recite a shura from the Quran in a slow, sonorous tone.
We begin with the name of Allah, who is most kind and merciful. O Allah, grant him full faith, everlasting security, abundance of provisions, maturity of mind, beneficial knowledge, guidance to perform righteous deeds, noble character, honour and sound health.
Ben Abram nodded to the slave girl, who knelt in front of Dorian and took hold of his penis. She began to manipulate it with a milking motion. Swiftly it swelled and stiffened, and the girl modestly averted her eyes, but she continued to fondle him until he was fully erect. Then Ben Abram selected a small, razor-sharp knife from the tray and came to them. He said softly to the girl, "Enough," and she moved away.
In the name of Allah, Ben Abram said, and made the first swift, practiced stroke of the blade.
Dorian stiffened at the sting, but he bit down and stopped the cry of pain before it reached his lips. Then came the next cut, and the next. But still he fought back any outcry, and felt the blood run warm down his thighs. At last Ben Abram laid aside the knife. In the name of God, it is done. And he bandaged the wound. Dorian felt his legs quaking under him, but he kept all expression from his face and his eyes open. Even Al-Alama gave voice to his approval.
Now you are a man, he touched Dorian's forehead in blessing, and you have conducted yourself as a man indeed.
Ben Abram took his arm and led him to a back room in the palace, where a sleeping mat was laid ready for him.
I will come in the morning to bandage the wound again, he promised.
In the morning, Dorian was flushed and hot, and the wound was ugly and inflamed. Ben Abram changed the dressing and laid on it a soothing ointment. Then he administered a bitter-tasting potion. Within days, the fever had abated and the healing had begun. Before long, the scabs had come away, and Ben Abram allowed Dorian to go alone to the ocean side of the island, to swim in the warm, clear waters, and to go down to the royal stables and help the grooms exercise the prince's horses, galloping along the white, fluffy sand of the beaches and joining in the wild, rowdy games of pulu. Soon after, a sail was sighted coming up the channel, and the lookouts on the palace walls picked out the royal pennant at the masthead. The entire population of the island flocked down to the beaches to welcome the return of Prince Abd Muhammad al-Malik from the Omani capital of Muscat. The prince stepped ashore to the boom of cannon from the battlements of the fort, the ululations of the women and shouts of adoration from the men. They fired their long-barreled jezils in the air while the drums beat and the fifes wailed. Dorian was with the grooms, who were holding the horses at the head of the beach. He had helped to burnish the tack and polish the turquoise gemstones that adorned the prince's saddle and the cheek pieces of the bridle. As an adopted royal son, the head groom had accorded to Dorian the honour of leading Al-Malik's stallion forward and holding him for the prince to mount. Dorian watched the prince coming up the beach, the crowds opening before him, and his subjects prostrating themselves, trying to kiss the hem of his robes as he passed by. It was over a year since he had last seen him, and Dorian had forgotten how tall and regal he was in his snowy robes, with the great jewelled dagger at his waist, its hilt of polished rhinoceros horn glowing with the soft lustre of amber. The headband that held his keffiyeh in place was of twisted gold wire. He strode towards where Dorian waited for him, smiling and returning the greetings of his subjects with the elegant gesture of blessing, touching his heart and his lips. "Salaam alaikum, great lord," Dorian bowed. Even though his voice was lost in the tumult of the crowd, the prince looked into his face, and Dorian saw from the pleased expression in his dark eyes that he recognised him. The prince inclined his head slightly, then swung up into the saddle with the grace of an expert horseman and rode away towards the fort. The prince sat with his closest courtiers on the terrace of the palace, sipping coffee and listening to the reports of the men who had administered the islands and colonies in his absence. "There have been many Frankish ships calling at Zanzibar," his vizier told him. "More each month now that the Kuzi wind brings them in from the south. They will seek to trade for ivory and slaves." The Sultanate of Zanzibar was part of the prince's domains, and a share of the profits from its markets found its way into his treasury. He could be sure that his subservient sultan would mulch the infidel for every rupee that the trade could stand. "Ali Muhammad must warn the infidel captains that I will not tolerate their presence north of Zanzibar. I most strictly forbid it." The gold and goods that the infidels brought with them were welcome, but Al-Malik knew full well the avarice and ruthlessness of the Franks. They had already established factories and bases in the empire of the Great Mogul. Once they had a foothold, they were impossible to budge. They must not be allowed to come as far north as Lamu. "Ali Muhammad is fully aware of your commands. If any infidel ship ventures into these waters, he will send report to your excellency by swift dhow." The prince nodded. "If the call for ivory is so great, how plentiful are our sources on the mainland?" "Ivory is every year more scarce, and the call of the infidel for more always greater." In a great part, the markets on Zanzibar and Lamu relied on the pagan black tribes of the interior to supply their needs. The tribes did not have muskets with which to hunt the giant pachyderms. Their method was to set primitive pitfalls lined with sharpened stakes into which they tried to stampede the herds. There were a few intrepid hunters among them who were capable of bringing down the elephant with bow and arrow, but their harvest was meagre. "Perhaps we should sell muskets to the chiefs to help them to gather greater quantities," a courtier suggested cautiously. But the prince shook his head vehemently. "That is too dangerous," he said. "It may encourage them to revolt against our authority. We would be opening the door of the lion's cage." They discussed the question at length, and then the prince turned his attention to the slave trade. "As we harvest the slaves from the coastal areas, they are driven further into the interior. Like the elephants, they become wilder and more wary. Each season the numbers we are able to obtain fall off." As with the ivory, the Arabs relied on the more warlike chiefs of the interior to fall upon their neighbours and to capture slaves from their traditional tribal enemies, then to bring them to the gathering points on the shores of the Great Lakes. "We might consider sending our own warriors into the forests to capture slaves," someone proposed. The prince stroked his beard thoughtfully.
We would have to send good men and bold. We cannot know what they will encounter out there in the wilderness. We can only be sure that it will be dangerous and hard. He paused to consider the suggestion further. I will give my decision on this later. But in the meantime, draw up a list of the names of 50 men who might be relied upon to lead such an expedition. He dealt with each of these matters concerning trade, but before he went on to other more serious topics, he dismissed the least important members of his council, and kept only 5 of his most senior and trusted men with him to hear the outcome of his visit to Muscat. This was perilous ground, which reeked of conspiracy and treachery. The caliph, Al-Uzaydin Yaqub, was older than the prince by 40 years, born of one of their father's wives when he was a young man. Al-Malik was the child of his father's dotage, and his father's last favourite. But as every horseman knew, an old stallion and a young mare breed the finest foals. The tiny Omani Empire was under grave threat from the conquering Ottomans, that mighty empire that had its capitals in Istanbul and Baghdad, and which sprawled across most of the Arab world. The only states that had so far resisted them were a few small principalities beneath the notice of the Turkish caliphs in the north, or those who had succeeded in defending themselves from the depredations of the Ottomans. Oman was protected by its strong fleet against attack from the sea. Any aggressor who tried to come at it overland from the north would be confronted by the ferocious sands of the Rub al-Khali, the empty quarter, and by the desert warriors who made up the small Omani army, and for whom the desert was home. Oman had defied the Ottoman conquerors for 100 years, and could do so for another 100 if only it were led by a strong and resourceful man. Ibn Yaqub was not that man. He was past 70 years of age and given to convoluted political intrigue and conspiracy rather than the rigours and hardships of war. His chief concern was always to safeguard his own position of power rather than hold together and protect his small nation. In the process, he had lost the respect of his tribes, for the Omani were made up of many, each under its own sheikh. Without firm direction, these hard desert men were losing their sense of purpose and resolve. They were beginning to squabble among themselves, resuscitating ancient tribal blood feuds, and spurning the rule of the vacillating, cruel, and scheming old man in Muscat. Ibn Yaqub's authority still held only close to his stronghold, but as it reached out into those burning deserts and across the endless waters of the ocean of the Indies, it grew ever more dilute and insubstantial. The desert sheikhs and the Dhow commanders would follow only a man they respected. Already some had sent secret emissaries to Al-Malik, for he had proved himself a mighty man and a warrior without peer. They all knew that the caliph had banished him to the outpost of the empire at Lamu because he was fearful of his half-brother's influence and popularity. The messengers promised that if he returned to Arabia, to the Omani, and headed a revolt against his brother, then they would rise behind him. With him at the helm of the state, they would once more unite against the Ottoman. It is your duty and your God-given right. If you come to us, then the mullahs will declare jihad, righteous war, and we will ride behind you to overthrow the tyrant, they promised. These were dire matters, and fraught with terrible perils. If they should fail, none of the 6 men seated on the terrace could doubt what the consequences would be for them personally. They sat long, debating the chances of success and the justice of their cause. When the council began, the dhows on the beach below them had been stranded by the ebb, high and dry, and heeled over. Long lines of slaves had wound out across the exposed sand to unload their cargoes. While the council talked, the tide began to flood, and gradually the ships righted themselves and floated free. They spread their matting sails and tacked out into the channel.